Hey y'all, it's Elena.
And it's Candace.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime. So how are you, Candy?
I'm good. I'm just, good.
Yeah.
Today was a weird day. I was all hyped up because the Murdoch murder trial started today, jury selection, and it was a very boring day.
Okay.
Trials in general are usually boring, but jury selection today was very uneventful. Was very much, if you are a 65 or older, please stand. And they was given all these exemptions and these bulk exemptions. He was asking if people had heard or read or, talked to people about the trial or the case. And please stand, it was those types of things. And I tell you, people were dropping like flies.
Oh, wow.
He would say, this is Judge Mullen. He would ask, would this affect your ability to be impartial on this jury? And everyone was like, yes. It's like, yep, bye.
Yeah, I don't want to be responsible for this.
Yeah, exactly. So, I'm very worried. I will say I'm really, really worried about them finding a jury to be impartial here. Mm-hmm. I'm very nervous because you're going to get one or two juries. Okay. You're going to get a jury made up of people who have the tentacles of the Murdoch family into their skin in some way, like whether they're scared of the family or they know, have known about the family for many, 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 many years. I'm talking his family has been in the solicitor's office for like 100 years.
Prominent.
There was a portrait of his grandfather hanging in the courtroom. But they had to take it down.
Why wouldn't they take it to a different jurisdiction or?
Well, they did. They took it to Colleton County. Which is in Walterboro, South Carolina. He is from Hampton County, South Carolina.
Okay.
That's where the Murdochs have ruled the roost for all this time.
Okay.
So yeah, it is very interesting to me.
Yeah. I'll have to tune in and watch it unfold with you.
Jury selection will take many days. I think his attorneys, Dick Karpootlian and Jim Griffin, I think they're going to make this process really painful for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
They're all about circus performing and they love the drama. So even people that said to Judge Mullen, yes, I think that this might affect my ability to serve on the jury or be impartial or whatever, they still wanted to keep that juror. So they said, we'll hang on to the juror and revisit. Anyways, so it's going to be interesting. I'm praying to God that we get some people on that jury that do the right thing.
Right.
If you don't know what we're talking about, guys, Alex Murdoch is accused of killing his wife and son. And if you think that's bad, this is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to this man and his crimes. So if you haven't what is the English language? if you haven't gotten involved in this case, it's like kind of like a part-time job. So if you're really wanting to binge something and get down in the weeds on something, go listen to the Murdoch Murders podcast from episode one.
Yeah.
And your head is going to spin. So,
I can't concentrate on the podcast because, like, I tend to listen to podcasts when I'm working and, like, it's in the background. So I would miss so much, I feel like.
There is so much.
Yeah.
And there is so much. It's just insane. It's like if someone created a Fargo or a limited series or a movie or some kind of TV show about this, people would probably drop off at like episode three or four because they'd be like, this is too muddled. There's too much going. Oop, just busted my mic. There's too much going on. There's like too many. This is not, you know, this wouldn't happen. It did. And it has. And like, we still don't know the lengths that his crimes have gone to. So I like talking true crime, like current events with you.
Yeah.
Maybe we should do some bonus episodes where we could talk and then upload them like an unedited conversation like that night or something.
Yeah.
Maybe for our Patreon.
Oh.
Who knows?
Okay, girl. I like the way you think.
Because I'm so interested in like the Koberger case, the Moscow, Idaho murders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I showered myself in the search warrant today and I just let the search warrant wash over me. Like,
don't they just keep finding things though?
Oh my gosh. And you know, we talked about this a while ago, how we felt like there was nothing, like the police weren't saying anything for weeks and weeks. Right. And we were like, this is kind of disturbing because who did this? Like, let's get this person off the street. I'm sure people in the area were scared.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm sure the remaining victims were scared because they were probably thinking, especially DM, that's her initials. She's the one who saw him.
Oh, God. I couldn't imagine.
I still don't know why he didn't kill her. I mean, thank God he didn't.
But I know.
He knew she saw him and he just left. So anyway, the search warrant, like, there is so much coming out now and it's like a treasure trove.
Yeah. Yeah. Every time I turn around, there's something new that they've unfolded or something.
Yeah. So. And, you know, we talk about a lot in our cases how there's a balance that law enforcement has to, this like tightrope they have to walk where they want to give X amount of information to the public, so they're kind of appeasing the public and the families, you know. And we talked about this in our last episode, how they couldn't even tell Tanisha's family that they kind of had a theory what happened to her body. You know, same goes in this case. They were nose to the grindstone over there. And we had no idea. I mean, they weren't peeping one peep. So we had no idea what they were doing, but they were working. They were doing it. Yeah. They were doing it. And now we know what they were doing this whole time. Now we know all the stuff they have on this guy.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Anyways. So
all that to
with
say,
all of that said, current events, a little current event take for you, but I'm excited to hear your case, Lena. Tell us about it.
Well, I will. Okay, so but
I will hang on.
So but first, you know, ever since you told me after we finished my last episode of Winona Green.
Yeah.
And you
Wino forever.
You kind of told me that I was saying the name incorrectly.
Well, I didn't say that.
No, you didn't.
Is it Winona or Winona?
Okay, so
I've been corrected.
Ever since you said that, like, it's been in the back of my mind, like, oh my goodness. I said Winona the whole time. So I apologize if that irritated anybody.
It didn't irritate me. I say Wynonna. I say Wynonna, what's her name?
Judd?
Not Judd.
Ryder.
Ryder. I say Wynonna Ryder. Yeah. And Daniel's like, it's Wynonna. And I'm like, you don't even go here. So you don't know.
Yeah. Listen, I'm just a hick from the sticks, okay?
Exactly. Let me be. Anyway.
I just wanted to say that little funny. Anyway, so today we're talking about Shirley Duguay. We're taking
it's pronounced Shirley.
Duguay.
Duguay.
No, it is Shirley, okay? It is Shirley. Shirley Duguay.
Don't call me Shirley.
Yeah. Shirley, Shirley.
Okay, let's do it.
Can you stop? Can you let me concentrate? Yes.
I'll have a drink of my tea.
Drink your tea. Okay, we're taking it back, or not back to, we're just taking it to Prince Edward Island in Canada.
Oh.
Shirley Ann Duguay was born in 1962. She was 32, and she was a mother of 5 children.
Holy moly.
The children's ages ranged from 15 years old to 8-year-old twins.
Oh.
The family lived in a small town of Richmond in Prince Edward, or on Prince what? They lived in the small town of Richmond on Prince Edward Island. And a little bit about Prince Edward Island, it's, if you want to know specifics, it's...
Mm-hmm, I do.
Okay, 2,170 square miles in size.
Oh.
It's one of the 13 provinces and territories in Canada. It is the smallest province in terms of land area and population, but the most densely populated. The island has several nicknames, which are Garden of the Gulf, Birthplace of Confederation, and Cradle of Confederation. Anyway, it's all rich in history.
Sounds lovely.
So Shirley, she was 4'9", and she weighed less than 100 pounds.
Aww.
So, yeah, she was a little lady.
Mm-hmm.
She had a pillow that she would sit on when she drove, I'm assuming to help raise her up to see.
Oh.
Or maybe she just wanted some cushions.
Or maybe she had a bad back. Like
I don't know. But she was estranged from her common law husband, and he was the father of 3 of her children. His name is Douglas Leo Beamish. And their relationship was on and off for about 12 years. In 1994, she had already ended things with Doug, and she worked hard for her family. On October 7th of 1994, a woman called the Royal Canadian Mounted Police to report an abandoned vehicle on private property in a field on Highway 169 near Tyne Valley. The license plates were missing from the vehicle.
Odd.
As the police opened up the car, they saw blood splatter on the windshield and throughout the inside of the car. It was noted that it was a medium impact blood splatter, meaning that the person was likely hit with something like a fist. They identified the owner of the car by the VIN, the vehicle identification number on the car. It belonged to Shirley Duguay. Investigators.
Was there a pillow in there?
We'll get to that. Oh. So investigators tried several times to contact Shirley by phone, but she didn't answer any of their calls. She didn't call back. They followed up by going to her house, and when they knocked on the door, her dad answered. Shirley's family told police that she had not been seen since October 3rd. And so here it is, October 7th, 4 days later. Shirley's father, Melvin, was looking after Shirley's kids since she had disappeared 4 days earlier.
Jeez.
I think it was typical for him to watch her kids while she ran errands and stuff, but Shirley told her dad that she was going to run errands, but she didn't give any specifics. But she said that she would be back in just a few hours.
Right, not 4 days worth.
Yeah. In one report, though, that I read, it supposedly Shirley was known to leave for days and come back days later.
Huh.
So no one reported her missing. Yeah, there was three reports that I read. One said that she was known for doing that. Another report said that she had done it before, like once. Mm-hmm. But in the third report that I read, it says the family didn't report her missing because they were afraid that her ex-common-law husband, Doug, would end up getting custody of the kids if CPS got involved. So they tried to hold out thinking that she would come home.
Yeah.
She was struggling. That makes sense. Yeah. She was struggling to make ends meet, and they thought that maybe she just needed a getaway. Detectives took a blood sample from her father, her brother, and her two sons to confirm that the blood in the car was Shirley's. This method is called reverse paternity.
Mm-hmm.
There was a spot of blood that was found in the car that did not match Shirley's. There were spots right. in there that matched, but there was one that just didn't match hers. About 500 meters away from the car, the pillow that Shirley used in her car was found with blood on it.
Oh, not her pillow.
Yes.
Cheryl.
In another area, a blood-stained T-shirt was found. Investigators searched over 100 square miles of land. They searched the waterways. They had helicopters for aerial view. They reached out to psychics and used hypnosis therapy to try to find leads. Psychics would say that Shirley was buried in a shallow grave under pine trees and by the water. Well, The island was filled with pine trees and was surrounded with water.
It's an island.
So, that yes.
Spot this, on.
It seems very likely. But a shovel was found about 2 miles away from Shirley's car. The shovel did have two black hairs on it, which Shirley's hair was black. Those hairs were microscopically similar to Shirley's hair. So this also led them to believe that her body was buried. Police asked Melvin, Shirley's father, who would want to hurt Shirley. He told police that Doug Beamish had been estranged from Shirley for about 18 months, and he should definitely be the top suspect. When Melvin was interviewed on forensic files, he said he should have killed Doug when he had the chance, before Shirley was murdered. He said that he would have done a good deed if he had killed him because Shirley would still be alive. When Melvin found out that Doug was physically abusive to Shirley, he had advised Shirley not to go back to Doug. So, I mean, we know that they were separated for 18 months. So she took her dad's advice. Shirley's friends were interviewed, and they all told investigators that they believed that Doug had something to do with her disappearance. Shirley had recently started dating again, and Doug was enraged about it.
I bet.
Yeah, her friends had witnessed him being enraged and physical with her in the past. A woman, during the investigation, a woman called investigators and said she had been watching the news stories about Shirley's disappearance. She had remembered seeing a car like Shirley's on a road called Allen Road, which was about 20 kilometers or about 12 miles from where her car was found. She said it was evening time, so it was already getting dark. However, she could see that there were two people standing outside of the car, a man and a woman, and they seemed to be arguing. This tip prompted investigators to search the area where she saw this encounter. Police found a bag containing a pair of men's size 9 white sneakers and a men's large leather jacket.
Leave the shovel, leave the bag of evidence, please.
Yeah. I mean, here's you a trail.
Right.
So the sneakers and the jacket had bloodstains on them. They were certain that this was the key to finding Shirley's killer. The blood on the leather jacket, it did match Shirley's DNA profile, so they knew it was involved in the murder somehow, or disappearance. Hmm. Investigators went to Doug's house to question him, and he was living at his parents' house at this time. When he did let them in, and when he was questioned, he said he knew the family would be accusing him, but he denied any involvement in her disappearance.
Why is that? Because she used to beat her?
Why would they think that, sir?
Yeah.
He said for the sake of the children, he and Shirley had worked out their problems, and said that the last time he saw her was a week or so earlier. He says on that last day that he saw her, Shirley agreed to give him a ride to work since he was having problems with his truck. On the way to his job, they had a pleasant conversation about the kids and planned to speak more about it later.
How precious.
Mm-hmm. When they got to his job site, they said goodbye and she just drove off. They hadn't spoken since. He said he could tell something was bothering her that day. He thought maybe she left town to visit her friends in Toronto.
Yeah.
Is it Toronto or Toronto?
That's funny. If you're from Toronto, you say Toronto.
Yeah.
I have friends that live in Toronto and they say Toronto.
Yeah. I've heard that before, so I'm like, I just had to point that out. But when investigators followed up with friends in Toronto, they confirmed that they haven't seen or they hadn't seen or heard from Shirley. Mm-hmm. Investigators asked him what size shoe he wore. He told them size 9.
Right.
Do you remember the white sneakers that were found?
I do.
Yeah. Yep. Size 9.
Yeah.
They hired a forensic podiatrist, and he says each person has a unique way of walking, which is shown in the imprint of the sole of the shoe and on the outside of the shoe. Investigators obtained a plastered mold of Doug's bare feet.
Oh.
So they had him step in styrofoam and do his foot imprint, and then they poured plaster and made this mold of his feet.
Freaky.
Yeah, and you're like thinking the whole time, okay, while he's sinking his feet into this, is he thinking, oh, they'll never get me? Or is he thinking,
like, what do they have that they're making me do this with my feet?
Right. Should I just go ahead and tell him? 'Cause
Surely. He knows. He left the shoes behind.
Yeah.
Dumb.
So investigators compared that to the wear pattern in the pair of white sneakers that were found. They then used a computer program that showed the forces or stresses or the points of pressure and how the wear patterns were created.
Mm.
The forensic podiatrist took into account the way that Doug's toes curled up, creating a wear pattern on the top of the inside
of
the shoe.
Weird.
Yeah. And also noted was that his feet turned inward So that also creates a pattern. So the cast of Doug's feet matched up perfectly to the insoles of the white sneakers. He was the forensic podiatrist was confident that Doug was the one that wore those white sneakers. And of course, he still denied that the shoes and the leather jacket were his. Mm-hmm. Inside of the leather jacket,
Are you going to say his name was stitched?
Wouldn't that be amazing? No, this is where it gets neat. Okay. So investigators found 20 small white hairs. They quickly agreed that these hairs were not human hairs. They belonged to an animal. Mm-hmm. Investigator Savoy remembered seeing a cat in Doug's house when he interviewed him.
I knew you were going to say it was a cat.
Uh-huh.
Doug. Yeah. The cat man.
Yeah.
Figures.
So investigator Savoy remembered that the cat named Snowball, because he was white.
Yeah.
Rubbed up against, yeah. So the cat rubbed up against the investigator's leg, which left a lot of little hairs on his pant leg. Well, those hairs looked identical to the ones that were in the leather jacket. So if they could prove that those white hairs were Snowball's, they could prove that this was Doug's jacket. So after calling around to several forensic labs to find someone to test these hairs, all of these forensic labs, they couldn't find anyone. So their last ditch effort was when they called. Yeah, because
they couldn't find anyone to test the hairs?
Not a forensic lab, because at this point, nobody had ever used an animal for forensic testing.
Oh, because it was in the 90s.
It was in the 90s.
Oh.
So this is the very first case for animals to be used.
No way.
Yes. So their last-ditch effort was when they called Dr. Steve O'Brien. He was a geneticist at the National Cancer Institute in the United States. He had actually spent years dedicated to studying hereditary illnesses in cats.
Wow.
Yeah, so he said he would absolutely help and that he would just need a sample of Snowball's blood.
Just send it on over.
Yeah. So on the Forensic Files episode, Melvin, Shirley's father, he said that Mr. Savoy told him that he went to Doug's house and read out the cat's rights to the parents.
Oh my gosh.
And so Melvin said, he asked Mr. Savoy, what did the cat say? And Mr. Savoy says, meow. That's such a dad joke. I love that her dad said that joke on Forensic Files.
Oh, Melvin.
Yeah, he seemed like a sweetheart. So Detective Savoy said it was like Snowball knew what was going on because he did not want to be caught. They chased him from room to room. And he kept going under the bed, and it took about 30 minutes before they could get their paws on him.
It's a typical cat, though, you know? They don't want to be, you know, they don't want to assist in any way. No. They can't be bothered.
No, they cannot.
I'm sorry if you're a cat lover. I just really hate cats.
I do too.
I can't hide it. I'm so sorry.
I've only loved one cat in my life. That was Wendy. Do you remember Wendy?
Yeah, Wendy, Grammy's cat.
Yeah. So Snowball was taken to the local animal hospital so that they could get the blood sample. And his blood sample and hair was taken in person to Dr. O'Brien in the United States.
Wow.
Yeah.
I would say. Yeah. I would say let's not send it USPS.
No, they're going to make sure that there's no contamination. So the DNA profile of the hairs on the jacket were a perfect match.
my gosh, you gotta be kidding me right now.
We're so dumb.
Oh my gosh. You remember that time we were, I think we were in your van, like parked outside Mott's or something, and your parents ran in, or maybe, I don't know, it was at that strip center, and we were just looking at each other, like crying, laughing. We did that a lot.
Oh, yeah. That was all the time. Like, what are you talking about that one time?
I know. I just remember that time in particular. We were just, like, doing our language that we used to do.
Yeah.
And making each other laugh, like, tears, like, almost throwing up laughing.
Oh, man. Oh, Lord, the good Lana. Times. Okay. So, yes, it was a perfect match to the ones taken off of Snowball's body. They even tested DNA from 20 other cats on Prince Edward Island to make sure there wouldn't be another chance for another cat to be a contributor. Mm-hmm. The results showed that the chances that the hairs found on the jacket belonging to any other cat other than Snowball was estimated to be 1 in 45 million.
Wow.
On May 6th of 1995, after 7 months of searching in a wooded area of North Enmore, a fisherman saw a pile of brush on the bank of the river that looked odd. He decided to check it out and started moving the brush away. To his surprise, he uncovered a human body. The shallow grave, the shallow grave was near the water. Under pine trees, just like the psychics had suggested.
That is remarkable.
Right. And there lay Shirley's battered and partially decomposed body. Ugh. Her hands were tied behind her back, and the autopsy showed that she had been strangled and proved blunt force trauma. Her nose and her jaw were broken, and her front tooth was in her lung. She had aspirated her tooth.
Oh, my gosh.
No. Bless her heart.
And that happened when she was alive.
Yeah, yeah.
Lord.
As if the shoes and the cat hairs weren't enough evidence, they confirmed that the other person's blood that was found in the splatter of blood in Shirley's car was Doug's. Mm. Investigators believe that Doug manipulated Shirley to give him a ride, and he led her to a remote spot and then beat her to death. He was arrested and charged with first-degree murder and held without bail. Police discovered a one-page written letter from Doug to Shirley threatening to kill her and the kids and then himself.
Oh, Lord.
Before he would allow her to get custody of the children.
And they were his kids, biological?
Three of the kids were his,
biologically. And he was threatening to kill them.
Mm-hmm. Before letting her have sole custody. So this was the motive, obviously. Yeah. But this letter was written in blood. In
what? Doug's blood.
Yes, he wrote this letter to Shirley in blood. How evil is this?
What?
I mean, murder is evil anyways, but...
That is chilling.
Yeah.
That is like... He sat there and had to, like, draw blood to do that.
Exactly.
Ugh.
Mm-hmm. So, they also found a picture of Doug that was taken just the day before Shirley's disappearance. Can you guess what he was wearing in that picture?
I'm gonna go with a black jacket and some white shoes.
Well, I think the leather jacket was brown, but yes.
Oh.
The leather jacket.
The leather jacket. And the shoes?
Well, I think it was just the top half. No. Oh, okay. So, Yes, he was wearing a leather jacket.
Well, Jimmy cracked corn.
And I don't care. Mm-hmm. So, during the trial, a woman that Doug dated in the 80s testified against Doug. She testified that Doug sexually attacked her with a knife in hand while her kids were home.
My gosh.
And might I add that Doug was an ex-convict and on parole when he murdered Shirley.
What? I hate this.
I know. I'm not sure what for. I didn't find any information of what his previous conviction was, but yeah.
Ugh, probably crazy. Assault. I mean, I'm sounds sure. like he was like a career. Offender. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. A jailhouse informant testified at the trial that Doug had admitted to him that he did kill Shirley. And on July 19th of 1996, Doug was tried and convicted of second-degree murder. I think they knew they could get him on second-degree murder, and they didn't. I don't know why they didn't pursue the first degree. But he was convicted and sentenced to life in prison with no chance of parole until after 18 years.
What? No, he obviously cannot abide by parole, so let's not go there, please.
Well, there's a little bit more information here. So he appealed his conviction in 1998 and 1999. Both of those were rejected. In 2013 is when he was up for parole. He was 56 at this time. He was in an Ontario prison.
prison.
Reports state that his conduct was satisfactory, but he was very demanding and had made derogatory comments to a female officer. He had a psychiatric risk assessment in September of 2012. And they felt due to that he would not be a threat to the general public. However, he would be an elevated risk to intimate partners.
Yeah.
The parole board questioned his ability to not repeat the same behavior, so they denied his parole.
Thank you for that.
Yes. So there was some justice in that.
Yeah.
It was also said that Doug wasn't cooperating with his case management team while incarcerated, which led the board to believe he wouldn't be able to work with anyone attempting to monitor his reintegration into the community. So that's another reason the board denied his request for even just a day and full parole. Because apparently they can grant a one-day parole.
Oh.
A news report from October 4th of 2022, recent, says that Doug appeared at another parole hearing by video link from Dorchester Penitentiary in New Brunswick. He was granted this time a 12-hour escorted absence from prison.
What?
I'll explain. Doug told the parole board that he is not ready for full parole.
Wow.
After more than 25 years in prison. Shirley's sister, Marie Arsenault, she spoke at the hearing and she told the board that, so her quote is, "So many people in my family have suffered and are still suffering all these years later. The heart-wrenching domino effect of loss and pain will never go away." Marie said her sister's murder triggered a series of family tragedies, including the untimely death of another sister after she turned to alcohol to deal with the pain of Shirley's death.
No.
And then the suicide of that sister's husband.
Oh my gosh.
It's just a domino effect, just like
yes.
she said. And then her dad had 13 heart attacks. through the years. Yeah, through the years. And he actually ended up passing away in 2005.
Oh, rest in peace, Melvin.
Yes. Marie says, I am asking if the offender is released, he not be allowed to live in the Prince County area of Prince Edward Island. And at the hearing, Doug took responsibility for the first time of Shirley's death. He says, I don't know even where to begin to calculate what harm I've done. I've done more harm to Shirley's family, all over the extended family, all of Prince Edward Island. There's no way to gauge what impact this has had. He said the investigation in 1994 went on, and that only compounded their grief and suffering. I mean, so he sounds remorseful, but he, I appreciate the fact that he knows that he's still, like, he's not ready for full parole.
Did he say why he wasn't ready?
It's not stated why, but the 12-hour escorted absence from prison will allow him to go look at a halfway house. To see where he would want to relocate, or see if it's something that he could manage. Because I think that's part of his parole. He'll have to go to a halfway house and be reintegrated.
Yeah. Wow.
According to the parole board, Doug remains at a high risk of recommitting criminal acts of family violence. Mm-hmm. And his behavior and understanding of his actions still require improvement before full parole can be considered. One parole board member asked Doug to explain why he took so long to admit to Shirley's murder, and he said, it was easier to blame everybody else. I didn't want to look at what I had done and the damage I had caused. And they asked him, well, what changed? And he says, I had 3 heart attacks, I suffered kidney failure, and I nearly died a couple of times. When you get to that stage, you realize you need to clean up your past. So that's what I'm doing. I'm cleaning up my past.
Well,
and I don't know if he's just saying that for kudos on the board, because one report mentioned that at his previous parole hearing, he really didn't think that he would get approved for parole at that time. He just wanted to go to kind of see how it was going, what he needed to do, and, you know, kind of get a feel for it. So I don't know if he felt like he needed to say those things, or if that was really from the heart.
Well, maybe it was from the heart, but that doesn't change the fact that he did what he did.
No.
Obviously, and you have to be punished for that. You have to be held accountable. And he is still a risk for intimate partner violence, because he has shown himself to be a reactive person.
Oh, yeah.
You know? So.
Yeah. And if he's still making derogatory or, you know, comments to the female officers, I mean, that's a telltale sign. So he assured the board that he is not interested in going back to Prince Edward Island. Ultimately, the parole board ordered Doug to be escorted by a corrections officer and a parole officer during his 12-hour absence from prison. He's also ordered to have no contact with the victim's family. It didn't, in that report from October of 22, it didn't say what day. I mean, obviously, I don't think they would give what day he was going to be having this absence, but that's the last thing I read on him, so.
What are you going to do for 12 hours? I think I know what I would do. I'd go to Chick-fil-A, you know, probably go to Target, Home Goods, maybe.
Well,
just to look, because obviously I wouldn't have money to buy anything, but Chick-fil-A, definitely.
I thought I put it in here, but there was a It said something about a halfway house somewhere that he was going to look at. So I'm assuming that's what he was going to do on his 12-hour trip. But back to Shirley. I couldn't find an obituary for her, but her headstone reads, "Sadly missed by children, Jimmy, Jason, David, Waylon, and Shelley." Canada also has, I just wanted to mention, they have a National Day of Remembrance and Action on Violence Against Women, which is December 6th.
Wow. So
I thought that was nice. And they have a place where they put all the women's names of who have been murdered or died due to violence. So,
wow.
That's all I've got for y'all.
Thank you for including all the science for me. I loved
You're
it.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm. I know you did that just for me.
I did. And I know you loved the jokes even more.
I did. Hey, I have to tell you something really quick about animal DNA and hair.
Oh.
So I was listening to Nancy Grace's podcast. She was talking about the Koberger, the perpetrator of the Moscow... Yeah, one of the victims had a dog.
Oh.
And there were dog hairs found in his apartment. So, Cheryl McCollum, I don't know if you've heard that name before, but if you're a true crime enthusiast, which I suspect that you are because you're listening to Cousins on Crime, but she is a forensics expert. She founded the, nonprofit Cold Case Investigative Research Institute in Atlanta, Georgia. And she has been on, like, she's been a forensic analyst for many, many, like, high profile things. Anyway, she said that the cool thing about animal DNA is that you have not only the hair, you can get the DNA from the hair, but animals lick their fur. So now you have saliva DNA.
Oh, right.
So you can, if one fails, you know what I mean? Or you just get double the info. Like,
exactly.
Double the forensic power in court.
Right. Well, because a lot of times you may not get the root of the hair.
Right.
Which,
yes.
With Snowball, they were able to get... one of the hairs had a root, so but I didn't even think about the saliva being on the hair, so
now I'm sure back then, this case that you're talking about, because this was the first one, I'm sure that they didn't think about that. They're looking for the root, you know, they're not thinking probably, oh, the cat licked its fur, and that's how they...
Yeah, maybe
that's
not.
That's mostly how they groom themselves and shed. So, so interesting.
Yes, it is.
So, and I love that this was like a precedent case, too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the
that's
history
so cool.
of it. Yeah.
Well, Shirley, honey, I hope you're sitting on your pillow up in heaven, just feeling fine.
Rest in peace.
Rest in peace. And you're so right about the cascade of events. It's like smacking a piece of glass. It just, the damage of a murder, the damage of a loss is so far-reaching, like, that sometimes you don't even know. Like, you don't even know the people that she may have encountered that she really affected and touched, you know?
Exactly.
Man, two domestic violence cases.
I know. I feel like I'm copying you. Like, we did the same kind a couple before, and now we're doing... Yeah, so we're going to have to do something different. Hopefully, you've got something different for us next week.
Yeah, it won't be domestic violence, but...
That was great. Let's do it again sometime.
Yeah, let's do it again.
Bye.
Bye, guys. Bye.
Well, thank you for listening to Cousins on Crime. If you're enjoying our podcast, please leave us a 5-star rating so that other true crime fans can find us.
If you have any case suggestions or just want to say hey,
email us at cousinsoncrime@gmail.com. And be sure to follow us on Instagram, where we post case photos and information at Cousins on Crime Podcast.